Is anyone having any trouble hearing me with this on? Very good. What a great pleasure it is tonight to be here. And boy, am I relieved the Nationals won. Or else, I'd be looking out and seeing a lot of down faces. I'm John Hoptackett. It was a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation to speak. Thank you for the great dinner across the way. Tonight's topic is going to be the Battle of South Mountain, the first major battle fought north of the Potomac River during the course of the Civil War. But before I get started, who among us have been to the South Mountain battlefields? Very good. I'm glad to see that. I'll tell you about my first visit. What wasn't mentioned, and which does relate to this story, my wife and I, we moved to the Gettysburg area back in 2004, and the following year I was very lucky to have been hired as a ranger at Antietam. And when I was hired, so was a colleague of mine by the name of Manny, okay? Now, my wife and I, we don't have any children yet, okay? But when we moved, got the house, she was looking ahead, she took my vehicle to yard sales, and she began purchasing strollers, baby seats, car seats, changing tables, and they were all in the back of my car. And I did not yet move them when Manny and I, my colleague, decided to go tour South Mountain. We'd never been there before, so we thought, what a great opportunity. We took a day off, we went, and we explored those back roads and the mountain passes, very narrow roadways. We did what Civil War tourists do on battlefields. We stopped in the road, we got out, kept the doors open, backed up, turned around, you know. And we did Turner's Gap, and we did Fox's Gap, and we decided, let's go down and do Crampton's Gap. And as we made our way toward Middletown, just west of Frederick, a state trooper passed us going the other way. And it wasn't long before he was right in the rearview mirror with the lights on. So I turned to Manny, and I said, was I speeding? And I wasn't. So I pulled over, and very cautiously, the officer approached my vehicle, hand on his gun, and he asked me to step out of the car. And I did, and I sat on the curb. Next thing you know, he had all my four doors open, my trunk popped, and two more state troopers pulled up behind him. Now, as I sat there, I had a Civil War shirt on that I had made myself with my favorite general on it, okay? And I thought, oh boy, what would the mugshot look like? And I kept hearing the radio traffic on their radios. And I kept thinking to myself, oh, please, please don't hear this at Antietam Battlefield as they read my last name, because I just got hired there. Well, it turns out there was a rash of home break-ins up in the South Mountain area. And it just so happened the suspect or suspects had a very similar 1994 Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra. So the officer came back to me, and he asked me to describe the contents of my car, which I did. And I kept thinking, please don't ask if I have children. Because in the back seat was the car seat and the changing table and everything my wife had gotten. That would be some tough explaining. That was my first trip to South Mountain. But it hasn't stopped me from going back. And South Mountain, I think, for far too long has remained in those shadows that have been cast by Antietam. You know, and why not?
Yeah.
How did it end? Oh, they couldn't find anything. So we pulled away, and my colleague Manny turns to me and says, you know, they still think we did it. They just couldn't prove it.
So, you didn't need my cousin Vinny.
I didn't need my cousin Vinny. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Did not need my cousin Vinny, yes. But boy, the folks in Middletown, and I spoke to Frederick County just a few days ago, and I said, you have a great vigilant state police force here. Antietam, of course, is still best remembered today in the history books as the bloodiest single day in American history. 23,000 casualties within just 12, 13 hours of battle. Of course, it was the battle that would bring an end to the first invasion of Union soil from the Confederate Army. It was also the battle that would lead directly to the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. So it's easy to see why Antietam would dominate the history of the Maryland campaign. But what I'm going to ask you to do tonight is forget Antietam ever happened, okay? Let's not approach the Battle of South Mountain by looking back from Antietam, which has been all too often the case. And I think over the years, South Mountain has been regarded or viewed as almost a stepping stone or something along the inevitable path that led to Antietam. But what I'm going to ask for us to do tonight is begin on September 3rd and end on September 15th of 1862. So not only erase Antietam from our minds, let's pretend it never happened. In fact, let's pretend it's not even 2012, okay? Let's try to put ourselves at the moment, okay? And I think as we do that, a different story of this battle will emerge. Now, on September 3rd of 1862, Robert E. Lee was nearby. In fact, he was at Drainesville. He would summon his military secretary toward his headquarters, Armistead Long, and he would dictate that very famous dispatch to Jefferson Davis. The present seems to be the most propitious time since the commencement of hostilities for this army to enter Maryland. Now I ask you, when was the last time any of us used that word propitious in day-to-day language? I'm not even quite sure I know what it means. But but Robert E. Lee will summon his military secretary and he will begin that very famous letter announcing to his president, to Jeff Davis, that he intended to go into Maryland. Now, Robert E. Lee at this point, it must be remembered, was still a relatively new Army commander. He had just taken command of his Army of Northern Virginia 3 months prior to this, back on June the 1st, but what a remarkable turnaround. During his first 90 days at the helm of this army, victory followed victory. He, of course, defeated McClellan outside of Richmond during the Seven Days battles. He marched north and he crushed Pope at Second Manassas, and he had driven back toward the Union capital two different Union forces. So those Union armies had been pushed back into the capital, and Robert E. Lee is now on the doorstep of Washington. Robert E. Lee will decide the time had arrived to go north. So on September 3rd, the events were set in motion. And on the following day, the 4th of September, near Leesburg, this most momentous campaign got started. So the question now is, why is Lee going north? Okay, what are the reasons behind this campaign? There are many. There's a lot of practical reasons. Live off the land. Okay, his army was hungry. His men needed food, of course, and Maryland was untouched by war, and just by the way, it was harvest time. So he was hoping to gather some much-needed provisions from the countryside. But I'm going to argue that Robert E. Lee went north because he really had no other choice. Mm-hmm. What are his options? You know, does he stay around this area? He can't do that. This area is desolate. It's bare. He can't fall back either. You know, he had worked too hard to gain this initiative. You know, and with the Union Army falling back, if he were to retreat deeper into Virginia, that would only give the Union Army time to gather strength, go after him again in Virginia, where this war had been raging for the past 18 months. And certainly, he thought, he can't attack Washington. There was widespread panic in the Capitol. That much was true. There's a lot of politicians and even some military officials believing they were convinced that Lee was heading toward Washington. But Lee knows better. He knows his army would not be able to attack the city. And even if they gain it, how long could they stay? So the only other option is to do what? Keep going north. It's almost he's a victim of his own success. Momentum was carrying him north to the Potomac River. He decided to grab onto that initiative and just go on for the ride. So he told Jed Davis that he would be going north. He didn't wait for the president's response. He didn't wait for Davis's approval when on September 4th, his army began crossing the river into Maryland. Now, as I mentioned, up to this point, everything seemed to be going right for the Confederate Army. And Lee, again, very confident in his men. His men are gaining confidence in him. But it seemed as soon as his men set foot on Maryland soil, everything would very quickly fall apart. This campaign is nothing but headaches for Robert E. Lee. And that first problem was probably the most recognizable one. It was the condition of his men. Now, his army had been on the move for 90 days, okay, marching, fighting all the way north from Richmond. Lee, on September 2nd, will have over 60,000 men present in his army. Now, let's go back really quickly to Antietam. On that battlefield, he was lucky if he had 45,000 left. Lee's army is melting apart every day of this campaign. Men dropping out of the ranks, straggling was at an all-time level. Now, Lee will write a letter, sometimes two a day, to Jeff Davis during the course of this campaign, and he will complain oftentimes about the straggling from the ranks. It came to be such a problem that at one point, Lee would write that for some of the men, straggling results from necessity. They're tired and they have no shoes. But for the greater number, it results entirely from design. These men are the cowards of this army who desert their comrades in the hour of need. Lee's language, we can sense that frustration as he's embarking upon this most important campaign and his army is falling apart. So straggling's a problem for Lee. Another problem Lee will encounter in Maryland, well, unexpected, his opponent, George McClellan. And I sometimes get a hard time at the park. Some of you who were with me a couple days ago, last week with Gary Edelman and the photography tour, well, I guess the key word was McClellan is my hero, right? Not quite there yet, but George McClellan, of course, is one of these figures that I don't need to tell you. He doesn't have a good reputation in the overall sense of things, right? What are some words used to describe McClellan from a personal point of view? Arrogant. Boy, that didn't take long. Napoleon complex, egotistic, right? How about from a military point of view? What are some words you to describe? Slow, cautious, timid. Boy, reluctant.
The perfect is the enemy of the possible.
There you go. Very good. Perfect enemy of the possible. I like that. I like that. Boy, when I have kids in the room, I don't ask that question. George McClellan has been described like that and many other things, many other ways over the years, and it might have been true that he was not the most pleasant guy to know. You know, maybe he did think highly of himself. But in early September, boy, George McClellan was precisely, I think, who Abraham Lincoln needed. Because again, let's put ourselves in that moment. Early September, okay? Two Union armies have been driven back, defeated, demoralized, spirits were low. There is panic. Now, just a few months earlier, the newspapers are predicting that this war would be over by the 4th of July, and the troops would be home by Christmas. Well, things were looking so good that spring that Edwin Stanton decided to close down all the recruiting offices in the North. They didn't need any more volunteers. Well, now, of course, they do. And in the midst of this crisis, Abraham Lincoln will turn to McClellan once more and ask him to take command of all the Union troops in the Capitol. McClellan wrote to his wife, "It is a terrible task, it is a thankless task, but he did accept. He was called upon once more to pick up the pieces from this summer's worth of defeat. He was there in late July of 61, after First Manassas. Here he is again in early September of 62. And contrary, I think, to how historians traditionally view McClellan, I think he does go about his work with great energy. Because within a matter of days, not only does McClellan piece together a brand new army, and when I say brand new army, I mean it is a brand new army. He has the elements of his 2nd Corps, the 4th, elements of the 4th Corps, the 5th Corps, the 6th Corps. That was his old army that fought outside of Richmond. But he's also inheriting John Pope's army. He'll turn that into the 1st Corps. He'll turn them into the 11th and the 12th Corps. He'll leave the 11th Corps behind, but he'll take to the field with the 1st and the 12th. And he also has this large corps, the 9th Corps, under Ambrose Burnside and Jesse Reno. All of these troops he was unfamiliar with. He didn't know them. You know, and as he goes toward Maryland in pursuit of Lee, he's having to get to know their commanders. And he's leaving behind generals like Nathaniel Banks and Irvin McDowell. And he's putting in other guys like Joe Hooker. And he's pleading with Lincoln. Look, I understand that Fitz Porter and Will Franklin are under charges for court-martial for 2nd Manassas, but please, please, let me have them for this campaign, okay? And Lincoln will relent to that. So George McClellan went about his work with great energy, and within just a matter of days, he is marching out of Washington, and he's in pursuit of Lee, moving much quicker, I think, than Lee had ever thought. Now, there is a letter on September 9th, that Lee would write to Jeff Davis, telling him that from what my sources gather, the Union Army is still gathered about their defenses of Washington. But on that very same September 9th, George McClellan was clear out of the city and was heading toward Frederick. Again, he's almost on the heels of Lee, and Lee, for the most part, will be kept unaware of it. Now, again, Robert E. Lee embarks upon this campaign. There was so much at stake. He's going north, looking to the countryside, looking to the people of Maryland, but primarily he's going north to pick a fight, okay? That was his number one goal. Go into Maryland, make the Union Army follow, and draw it to battle on good defensive ground. It doesn't quite matter if that ground is in Maryland or perhaps Pennsylvania, as long as it's north of the Potomac, as long as it is Union soil. So despite the problems he's encountering with the straggling from the ranks, with the unreceptive citizenry, he told Jeff Davis that if ever we have an opportunity for the people of Maryland to cast off the yoke of Yankee oppression, this is it. And he knew how to sell this plan to Davis, and that's what Davis wanted to hear. But after a few days after crossing the Potomac, he will very quickly disabuse Davis of this notion. Accepting individual expressions of kindness, do not anticipate a general rising of the people in our behalf. So again, just things continue to go poorly. Lee, though, got his army across the Potomac and toward the city of Frederick, safely across, and he pauses in Frederick, Maryland for a few days. He gives his men time to catch their breath, but now he must continue with this invasion. And in order to continue, he doesn't want to keep going north out of Frederick. He needs to march his army west. He needs to establish a new line of supply. Of course, the further that he traveled north of Frederick, the more vulnerable these supply lines became to Union troops moving out of Washington. So he was hoping to march west and transfer his army across the South Mountain Range. And once he got across the mountains, he could then turn north, continue up through Hagerstown into Pennsylvania, and establish a new line of supply south down the Shenandoah Valley. Okay? Well, it would be here that Lee will encounter the biggest problem of his entire campaign. It wasn't the condition of his army. It wasn't George McClellan. It was instead a very pleasant, very historic little town called Harper's Ferry. Okay? Harper's Ferry during the Civil War is sometimes known as the gateway village to the Shenandoah. And at Harper's Ferry and at nearby Martinsburg, there is a garrison force of Union soldiers. At Harper's Ferry, there were more than 10,000 strong. And Lee knew they were down there. That was no surprise for him. In fact, even before he came north, he was well aware of the presence of those Union troops. But certainly, he thought, as soon as he crossed the Potomac, his army would be squarely between them and Washington, and that would force them to abandon Harper's Ferry. He was assuming they would willingly give it up. Well, of course, they do not. So as Lee planned to evacuate Frederick, he discovered that those 10,000 Union troops at Harper's Ferry did not budge. And this is a problem, because if he were to continue west from Frederick, cross up over the South Mountain Range and go north, there would be about 10,000 Union troops directly behind him. So what do you do now if you're Robert E. Lee? What is your next course of action? Do you just send your entire army south to deal with those men? Well, of course not, because that would look like what?
A retreat.
Do you just keep going north, pretend they're not there? Can't do that either. So Lee will decide to do both. He is going to get his army across South Mountain, and he is now going to divide it into two pieces. Half of it, under James Longstreet, will remain encamped at a small town called Boonesboro, just at the western base of the mountain. And with Longstreet, there will be a division of troops under Daniel Harvey Hill. As Longstreet will settle in near Boonesboro, Stonewall Jackson will lead his men even further west, recross the Potomac near Williamsport or Sharpsburg, wherever he decided, and move on that small garrison at Martinsburg. Lafayette McLaws, John Walker, Richard Anderson, those divisions would move south toward Harper's Ferry. And I think that Lee was hoping, just by moving in that direction, he could convince those Union troops to leave. Doesn't necessarily want to get involved in a siege operation. That would take too long. So Robert E. Lee will decide to divide his army across western Maryland. And he will then call his chief of staff, Robert Chilton, toward his headquarters tent in Frederick. And he will then draft what will become known as Special Orders 191. Has anyone been to Monocacy Battlefield to see these? Excellent. Very good. I'll get back to that in just a moment. But 191, of course, are the orders that divided Lee's army. And on September 10th, the Confederate Army will evacuate Frederick. They'll start to make their way west, crossing up over the Catoctin Range, marching west up over South Mountain. They will then begin to spread out. Now, very quickly, Lee is going to fall behind schedule. He had anticipated, or he had hoped, that this entire campaign would take just about 3 days. In fact, within just 72 hours, he wants his army to be reunited. Within 72 hours, he wants those Union troops gone from Harper's Ferry. Then he could continue focusing toward the north. Well, very quickly, he falls behind. It's going to be 3 days even before the final elements of his army evacuated Frederick. The final division does not leave town until noon on September the 12th. Well, at 4:30 that same afternoon, guess who's arriving in Frederick from the opposite direction? Here comes the advance of the Union Army, right on the heels of Lee. And I've mentioned a few times about things going poorly for the Confederate Army, right? Just a few times. Well, then we have to get back to Special Orders number 191. Now, there have been more than 54,000 days that have passed since this war came to an end. There have been more than 60,000 books written about this war. Some of you have them all, right? But believe it or not, there are still some things we do not know. There are some unsolved mysteries, and a few of them relate to 191. Very simply put, there's a mistake. There's a miscommunication. Someone goofed up. And an extra copy of 191 was written out. And for reasons we still do not know, that extra copy just somehow got lost. Left behind in a field south of Frederick as the Confederate Army marched out of town, as the Union Army continued to gather, a soldier from Indiana found it. Rushed up the chain of command, it will land in the hands of George McClellan. And you'd be excited too, right? George McClellan had just arrived in Frederick to a perfect hero's ovation. The people of town turning out by the hundreds to welcome him as a liberator. He would brag to his wife that the women nearly pulled him to pieces. Trying to make her jealous. That's right. So there he was in Frederick. He had established headquarters, and he was entertaining the people of town, and he was entertaining the local politicians and the businessmen, and that is when a breathless courier will arrive and hand him 191. McClellan scanned it over quickly. He raised it over his head, and he declared, and I always get a laugh, "Now I know what to do." Okay? And that, I think, is a very important statement. Because up to this point, McClellan, as he followed Lee out of Washington, as he tried to keep between Lee and the Capitol, he had been hearing conflicting reports. Some of them told him that Lee and his army had crossed South Mountain and were now making their way toward Hagerstown, 12 miles northwest of Boonesboro. At the same time, other reports are coming in that Lee is heading where? But south toward Harper's Ferry. So how do you make sense of this? They're going in two different directions, aren't they? Well, 191 explained everything. Lee has divided his army. That is why he said, "Now I know what to do." And caught up in the moment, George McClellan will then wire the White House. "Mr. Lincoln or Mr. President, I have all the plans of the rebels before me and I will catch them in their own trap. I will soon send you trophies." And of course, he turned to John Gibbon and he said, "Here is a paper with which, if I cannot defeat Bobby Lee, I will be willing to go home." That is what people remember about 191. But over the years, some have taken a closer look. What does 191 tell George McClellan? It revealed a lot. It revealed that Lee's army had been divided. What does it not reveal? Something I haven't mentioned yet, and I haven't heard when I talked about McClellan as a military man. Numbers. Numbers. Yes, it was true that McClellan does believe he's up against a large army. Somewhere between 120,000 Confederate soldiers. I don't think there was a general in this war who ever said publicly or privately, "Boy, I outnumber those guys," you know, by a lot. Of course, you're always outnumbered, right? It makes your victories that much more. But George McClellan was convinced that he was outnumbered. And that's important to know. Because not knowing how many men Longstreet's wing had, not knowing how many men Jackson had, all he knows is that Lee voluntarily divided his force in unfriendly territory. And if you're George McClellan, what does that tell you? Lee must have a large army. Absolutely. He would not take that risk unless you do. So his worst fears have just been confirmed. And again, let's forget 2012. Let's forget we know how this war ends. What if, and the hypothetical is always this. I get this at the battlefield all the time. What if McClellan got 191 and he immediately moved out and attacked? And I counter by saying, and what if he did that and lost? What if he is defeated? What is left of the Union, right? Following this summer's worth of victories, The Confederate Army is triumphant. 7 days, Second Manassas. Of course, we know England is paying very careful attention to what's happening. All right, there's a growing anti-war movement in the North. So what happens if the Union Army is destroyed? George McClellan knows that he simply cannot lose the approaching battle. Talk about pressure, right? He is getting dispatches from Governor Andrew Curtin of Pennsylvania. The Confederate Army is on my doorstep, 250,000 strong, and they are heading toward Harrisburg. Don't let them get to Harrisburg. And McClellan wrote back and said, who cares if they get Harrisburg? And he would say the same thing to Henry Halleck, because Henry Halleck is telling him, don't fall for Lee's ruse. Lee is trying to trick you. Lee is trying to draw you out of Washington only to do what? Cut across the river and attack it from the south. That explains why he's heading toward Harper's Ferry. And McClellan responds to Halleck by saying what? Who cares? Who cares if Washington falls? What matters? What matters is this army. Because if this army is lost, all is lost. So McClellan, of course, he knows he cannot lose. He's looking at 191, convinced further that he's up against great numbers. And of course, when he did get 191, he had to first verify if it was true. Right? He has to verify whether or not Lee was actually still following this plan, if Lee's army was still divided. So he would send his cavalry out under Alfred Pleasanton. They go galloping out of Frederick, out of Middletown, heading closer and closer toward the mountain. And as they do, they continue to drive back Jeb Stuart, who had been keeping an eye on the approaching Union army. Well, later that night, Pleasanton is going to report that they could still hear cannon fire coming from the direction of Harper's Ferry. And that told McClellan that Harper's Ferry was still holding out. That told McClellan that Lee's army was still most likely split on the west side of South Mountain. So he will develop his plan of attack. The general idea is to cut the enemy in two and defeat him in detail. His plan was to move west from Frederick, cross up over the mountain, and place his army squarely between Longstreet and Jackson. Now, George McClellan only knows what he knows of the Confederate Army from 191. And what that revealed was that the bulk of the Confederate Army was just at the western base at Boonesboro. Longstreet's command was there, Harvey Hill's command was there, in McClellan's mind, 60,000 plus soldiers. What he doesn't know is that Lee almost immediately deviated from the plan. Because when Longstreet pauses in Boonesboro on September 11th, Lee sends him right north to Hagerstown, another 12 miles away. So when McClellan based his plan of attack for South Mountain, he's doing so not knowing that the Confederate Army was even further divided than what he believed. Longstreet was 12 miles north off the road from South Mountain. Now, the bulk of the Union Army would be following along the National Turnpike, today Alternative Route 40, as it moves west from Frederick. And the bulk of the Union Army would be led by the 9th Army Corps. Behind the 9th Corps would be the 1st Corps. Two corps that what? Never served under McClellan's command. Okay? So he is going to trust that to who I believe may have been the most successful general here in the East to wear blue up to this point in the war, Ambrose Burnside. Burnside and McClellan go way back. They were good friends. Burnside, of course, had just undertaken that expedition of the North Carolina coastline. And twice that summer, reportedly, he was approached by Lincoln to take command of the army. He turned it down both times. McClellan is going to lean very heavily on Burnside throughout the entirety of this campaign, not only at South Mountain, but also at Antietam, because he'll put Burnside in front of the most difficult terrain to have to fight his way across the creek. Everybody else got across unopposed. So McClellan's plan was to have Burnside's wing of the army lead the way and make their way toward South Mountain, toward Turner's Gap. And that's what I have to be careful for. Not a rock and roll star. That's okay. Burnside will be moving forward with the 9th Corps. Behind them will be the 1st Corps. Behind the 1st Corps would advance the rest of the army, the 2nd and the 12th, and finally the 5th. They were to move across the mountain and engage what McClellan believed was the large force of the Confederacy near Boonesboro. But at the same time, the key to his entire plan will be played out 6 miles further south. This belonged to the 6th Army Corps under William Franklin. Franklin's men were encamped at Buckystown. Franklin's plan was to get across Catoctin Mountain, make his way toward the small town of Burkittsville, right at the east base of South Mountain, and then fight his way across Crampton's Gap. When he got across Crampton's Gap, he was to move south and destroy Lafayette McClaws' division on Maryland Heights. That would free up the trapped soldiers at Harper's Ferry. And with those 10,000-plus men in tow, Franklin was told to turn back around and help out Burnside. Remember George McClellan for being timid and cautious, right? His plan called for Franklin to march his men at least 14 miles, cross over two mountains, fight two battles, and when then that was done, lend a hand to Burnside. He will tell Franklin, "I rely upon you at this critical moment to exercise all your intellect and your energy in carrying this out." So it was upon the shoulders of these 13,000 soldiers under Franklin, the key to McClellan's entire plan. This is to be the holding action, if you will, under Burnside, while Franklin delivered the knockout punch. Now, it was a good plan in theory, but on the night of September 13th, there were quite frankly too few men close enough to the mountain to carry that out. Only the 9th Corps is in Middletown. The rest of the Union Army still at Frederick, okay? 15 miles or more away. So they are too far away to carry out everything McClellan wanted them to do on the 14th of September. Now, McClellan's men, they hit the road early on the 14th, and at the same time, Robert E. Lee is very desperately trying to race his way back to the mountain. Lee had followed Longstreet to Hagerstown. Lee had established his headquarters at Hagerstown. And late on September 13th, very late that evening, into the night, Jeb Stuart arrives. And Jeb Stuart had most important news. "I don't want to alarm you, but the Union Army, they're just at the east base of South Mountain." You could hear the brakes hitting the pavement. This is a pivotal moment of the campaign. That was the first time Robert E. Lee discovered exactly where the Union Army was. And where were they? Right on his heels. He simply cannot allow the Union Army to get across South Mountain. That would put them between his divided force. So that night, he will send urgent messages back to Daniel Harvey Hill. Harvey Hill's division of 8,000 men had remained at Boonesboro. Their task was to prevent any Union troop from escaping Harper's Ferry to the north. But on the night of September 13th, there's new orders for Hill. Get up to the mountaintop and defend Turner's Pass, the main avenue right here, at all costs. Jeb Stuart, he was told, would be there to help. And Robert E. Lee is going to send note after note after note to McClaws at Maryland Heights. McClaws has 20% of the Confederate Army. Not only his division, but also Richard Anderson's division as well. These men were in a dangerous position because if the Union Army does get across at Crampton's Gap, they are directly behind them, and they have nowhere to go unless and until Harper's Ferry surrendered. So Lee will tell McClaws repeatedly, "Look out well to your rear. Do not let the Union Army get across these mountain gaps." Now, Longstreet, again, doesn't necessarily agree with this plan. That's something new, right? Longstreet asks General Lee, "Why in the world are we going to defend the mountains? Why? Why not just move straight south from Hagerstown and take up a line of defense behind the Antietam Creek?" Well, Lee says, "We have to defend the mountain. If we don't, McClaws is going to be destroyed." So he will send out messages for these troops to hold the passes, and Longstreet and those men will be racing their way back from Boonesboro on the morning of the 14th, trying to lend a hand. Now, the morning of the 14th, the 9th Corps led the way. In immediate command of the 9th Corps was Jesse Reno, and at the head of his corps marched Jacob Cox and his Kanawha division. Jacob Cox's men had been encamped at Middletown, and early on that Sunday morning, they make their way west toward South Mountain. And as they near the Catoctin Creek, Jacob Cox is surprised to find one of his brigade commanders standing by the roadside, a brigade commander who had been captured 2 days earlier when his division first arrived in Frederick, Colonel Augustus Moore. "Good morning. What are you doing here?" He explained he had just been paroled, that he's on his way back. But more importantly, asked Moore, "Where are you going?" "We're going up over South Mountain." And Moore said, "My God, be careful." And that was it. Because if he had said any more, he had been violating the terms of his parole. You see, Moore had been captured and then paroled, and he couldn't reveal any information to Cox. But from what he said, "Be careful," he knew there was trouble ahead. And that would be verified as he continued to move west, and he found Pleasanton. And Alfred Pleasanton and his cavalry had been doing skirmish firing with Jeb Stuart's men. And Pleasanton is going to tell Cox that South Mountain at Turner's Gap along the National Pike is being defended in strength. "There is at least one brigade up there," said Pleasanton, but you can move south on this old Sharpsburg Road, and you could then get across the mountain by way of Fox's Gap. Fox's Gap, 1 mile south of Turner's. So with that, Cox will turn his men off the main road and head up toward Fox's Gap. At the same time, racing toward Fox's Gap from the other direction, here comes additional Confederate infantry. Now, Harvey Hill was up early. He woke about 3:30 that Sunday morning. He had a quick cup of coffee. Then he rode from Boonesboro up to the summit of the mountain. He was expecting to find Stuart. He was told that Stuart would be there to lend a hand. What he found was a note from Stuart. Stuart told Harvey Hill that there's not much of a threat heading that way, that there's only one or two brigades of infantry, that McClellan would most certainly focus his efforts down toward Crampton's Gap, that much closer to Harper's Ferry. So he decided to go there. As Stuart galloped away from Turner's Gap, it would leave Harvey Hill alone on the mountaintop. And as he wrote later, "Never was there a feeling of greater loneliness." One of his brigades under Alfred Colquitt was up there. They were in position. It was these men that Pleasanton had detected. It was those men that had led the Ninth Corps to try to find their way around Fox's Gap. Harvey Hill will soon discover that if he was to hold Turner's Gap at all hazards, as he was instructed by Lee, he must also defend Fox's Gap. He must also defend another gap to the north, oftentimes known as Frosttown Gap. So Harvey Hill very quickly realized that if he is to defend Turner's, he also has to defend two other gaps. 8,000 men, five brigades, spread out across more than 3 miles of mountainous ground. A tough challenge. So he'll call back to Boonesboro for his additional brigades, and the first to arrive was Samuel Garland and his North Carolinians, about 1,200 men. Those men will arrive at Fox's Gap. They will take up a defensive position just a few minutes before Cox arrived, and there the battle began. Jacob Cox and his 3,000 Ohio troops were fighting their way up the mountainside, trying to secure Fox's Gap, but Garland's men were there to meet them. And for the next 2.5 hours, the battle is going to rage at Fox's Gap. Garland's men are spread very thin, and they were outnumbered more than 2-1. But they are literally defending a mountain. Those of you who have been there, what do you think about that ground? I could in my Oldsmobile, my old vehicle, it hardly made its way up the side of the mountain. So I couldn't imagine trying to fight up the mountainside. Jacob Cox's men are getting shot down left and right. And, of course, included among those wounded was the commander of the 23rd Ohio, and that was Lieutenant Colonel Rutherford B. Hayes. Rutherford Hayes, his left arm was shattered by a musket ball, and he lay in the fields on the slope of the mountain in between the two lines of battle. During a temporary pause in the firing, he yelled out to his men, "Hello, men of the 23rd, you're not going to leave me here, are you?" And a few of the men crept forward, and as soon as they did, they came under fire. They fell back. Then a lieutenant would run out, and he would rescue Hayes. Hayes would be taken to the rear. He'd be treated by the surgeon of the 23rd, his future brother-in-law, or in fact his current brother-in-law, Joseph Webb, who was a surgeon. Lucy would come by to Middletown to lend a hand during his recovery. Now Cox is watching as his men battle it out with Garland, and he decided there's only one way to end this impasse. That was to fix bayonets and charge. So just before 12 o'clock noon, his Ohio troops will surge up the mountainside, and they will very quickly overwhelm Garland. Garland's brigade will lose more than 50%, and included among those was Garland himself. 31-year-old attorney from Lynchburg, Virginia, commanding a brigade of North Carolina soldiers, but the men loved him. He had joined the Army. He's the grandnephew, I believe, of President James Madison. His wife had died just prior to the war. Now, Garland would be struck down. He is on the field too long, too late, and he turned to Colonel Thomas Ruffin of the 13th North Carolina, and he told Ruffin to make his way back, and Ruffin looked at him and said, "General, this is no place for you either. You're not safe here." Ruffin is shot down, and then Garland will be shot from the saddle. He's carried back toward the Mountain House, the old South Mountain Inn at Turner's Gap, which, by the way, served as Harvey Hill's headquarters for the duration of the fight. Garland would be he'll die that morning, and Harvey Hill would lament his loss. Garland's brigade scattered. Jacob Cox is in possession of Fox's Gap. So you might think, battle's done, right? Because they have turned the flank of Colquitt. All they need to do now is advance north, and there they are to destroy that force. But Cox doesn't advance. And you can't blame him, because his brigade had lost heavily, and he had no one behind him. The nearest support is still 3 hours away. Did I mention that McClellan's army was simply too far away from the mountain to carry it out? So from 12 o'clock noon until 3 p.m., the fighting is going to come to an end. Cox is going to hold Fox's Gap. And during those 3 hours, as the Union Army is continuing to make its way toward the mountain, during those same 3 hours, guess who's also arriving? This way, Longstreet. Longstreet's men had set out from Hagerstown that morning, and when they arrive, they'll make their way up the slopes of the mountain, and there they would have found Harvey Hill, probably wearing an orange or yellow reflective vest, because he was a traffic director, okay? As soon as every one of the brigades got up there, they are being sent that way, this way, that way, this way. Harvey Hill, the rest of his division had arrived. Robert Rhodes is sent up toward those gaps. George B. Anderson, Roswell Ripley, and other of Longstreet's men are sent back toward Fox's Gap. And Harvey Hill intends to retake that pass. He'll put Roswell Ripley in charge, and these men get hopelessly lost on the mountain. He did try to drive Cox away, but that planned counterattack never worked out. Now, what did happen? Only one of these brigades will still be in position when at 3:30 the rest of the Ninth Corps arrived behind Cox. And that was Orlando Wilcox's division, backed up by Samuel Sturgis, backed up by Isaac Rodman. The battle will renew 3:30 to 4 o'clock p.m. Thomas Drayton's Confederate brigade is destroyed on the mountaintop. They are overwhelmed. And by 4:30, the Union Army has again sole possession of Fox's Gap. But again, they'll pause. They'll halt. Wilcox had suffered heavy casualties. And Jesse Reno, he's going to gallop forward to find out what is going on. Reno is here with Burnside, with McClellan. They're at a place now known as Merrimead, which still stands along that National Pike. That is headquarters. And Reno is going to gallop his way to Fox's Gap, and he's going to ask, "Why are you not continuing your effort north?" "Well, there are too many Confederates," they said, "swarming through the trees, heading down the mountain pass." Jesse Reno will turn to John Hartranft, commander of the 51st Pennsylvania, and have him find out if that was true. So Hartranft will advance his men across the roadway, and they began to approach a skirt of trees. And as they did so, fire will break out. Just a few scattered shots. And one of those bullets will slam right through Reno. The regiment behind Reno was the 35th Massachusetts. It was their first battle. They leveled their guns to their front, and now they got the poor 51st PA in this crossfire in the middle of the field. But Reno was taken down, struck from the saddle. West Point, class of 1846, his classmates, McClellan, Jackson, Pickett. Reno, one of the best, one of the brightest. He is shot down, and his first thought was that he was struck by his own men. He saw Orlando Wilcox, and he said, "I've been struck down by my own troops. Can you believe this?" And then he found Samuel Sturgis. Now, Jesse Reno, just a little guy. He was about 5'4" in height, but very much respected by his men. And he found Sturgis, another West Point classmate. And he looked up and he said, "Hello, Sam, I'm dead." And Sturgis thought that was a rather bizarre thing to say. And he says, no, General, it's not as bad as that, I hope. Yes, I'm a dead man. Say goodbye to all." And with that, Reno died. One of the highest ranking officers in the war to give his life. Reno falls from the saddle just before twilight, and the battle for Fox's Gap comes to an end. 13 hours in length, the Ninth Corps has possession of it. Now, at the same time the Ninth Corps was fighting at Fox's Gap, here goes Joe Hooker and his First Corps. They were going around the mountain pass to the north, the Frosttown Gap. They were trying to turn Turner's from the opposite direction. Now, of course, Hooker, first battle as Corps commander. And as he advanced toward the front, he is met by Burnside. Burnside is going to detach one of Hooker's brigade, John Gibbons' men, the 2nd, the 6th, the 7th Wisconsin, the 19th Indiana, soon to become the Iron Brigade. The Iron Brigade was to advance up the National Pike and contend with Colquitt's men in position at Turner's Gap, while the rest of Hooker, led by George Meade's division, made their way up around the opposite end. Almost looks like a pitchfork, doesn't it? This battle, by the way, not so much McClellan's victory, Burnside's victory. It was Burnside who was overseeing the Ninth Corps and the First Corps, this double envelopment of the Confederate line. Now, Joe Hooker would rein up behind his men, and as he wrote later on, "The mountain to our front was difficult enough to ascend, even in the absence of a foe in front." Why couldn't he just say it was a steep mountain, right? George Meade's men are going to lead the effort. George Meade and his Pennsylvania reserves will move forward up the Frosttown Road and up a roadway today known as the Dahlgren Road. And as they made their way, they're going to encounter Robert Rose and his tough Alabama troops. Again, the fighting will be intense, but Meade will eventually be able to drive Rhodes back. Next to Meade, here comes John Hatch's division. They are going to drive back Kemper's brigade, Garnett's brigade, Micah Jenkins' brigade, all from Longstreet's command. By nightfall, Union troops have gained possession of that gap as well. The only success for the Confederates that day was right here along the National Pike. Colquitt's men didn't budge. Gibbon would send his men forward, and they would lose very heavily, but Harvey Hill would later proudly write that Colquitt's men at 11 p.m. were still holding the same ground they had at 4 a.m. Gibbon's men are unable to drive them back, but if you're Harvey Hill, you're in a very bad spot because the Union troops are on both of your flanks. Now, about 4:30 that afternoon, James Longstreet arrived on the scene. And when Longstreet got there, he insisted on taking command of the field. He called rank. Harvey Hill says, "General, I've been here all day. All right, I know the ground better than you. Why not just let me have it?" Well, Longstreet insisted. But that night, just after 10 o'clock, Hill and Longstreet will ride their way down the mountainside to Boonesboro. And at Boonesboro is Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee never once set foot on the South Mountain battlefields. He couldn't. He spent much of this campaign in the back of an ambulance. His hands were in splints. So imagine what it sounded like to Lee. Imagine if you're Lee and you had just undertaken this campaign of invasion 10 days earlier, where there was so much at stake, and all you could do now is listen to the battle unfolding. Here comes Longstreet and here comes Harvey Hill. Longstreet will turn to Harvey Hill and says, "Well, you tell him." And Harvey Hill is going to tell Lee the bad news. "The Union Army have gained our flanks. They're in possession of the gaps, and we can't stay here." Longstreet's going to later write that if we were allowed to stay, if we allowed McClellan the opportunity to attack us in the morning, we will be at his mercy. So Robert E. Lee that night will make a very painful decision. He will retreat. First time he orders a retreat since taking command of the army, right? The first time he has suffered a battlefield defeat. He will order his men to slip quietly off the mountainside that night, make their way west to Boonesboro, then make a left-hand turn, moving southwest toward a small town called Keedysville, toward another small town called Sharpsburg, and toward the Potomac River beyond. The campaign, he thought, well, he needs to readjust. He needs to fall back. He needs to retreat. Now, again, imagine Antietam never happens, okay? Hopefully you didn't think once about Antietam the entire time, right? Robert E. Lee is lost. 10 days into this campaign, imagine the impact it had on the Union Army. What kind of condition were they in just 10 days earlier? Defeated, demoralized, driven back into Washington, and now spirits are going to soar when on the following morning they'll wake up and find the hillside vacant of Confederate troops. They've defeated Robert E. Lee. We could do this. Now, Robert E. Lee is going to fall back. As he retreated from the mountainside, he will send those very famous letters down to Lafayette McLaws. His attention was still on McLaws. The day has gone against us, and we will retreat from the mountain towards Shepherdstown, just on the Virginia side of the Potomac. You are desired to meet us there. Several times he'll send that message. Not once will he hear back from McLaws. They didn't get through. And the reason why? There are Union troops right behind McLaws. William Franklin and his Sixth Corps. Remember Franklin? All of this was the holding pattern. Here comes Franklin. 5 a.m., his 13,000 men are on the move. They scale up over the Catoctins. And by the way, the next time you're on 15 North and you cross the river at Point of Rocks, when you see the road, Mountville Road, to your left, take it. Because you get an incredible view from up there. You can see the whole Maryland campaign from that summit. But if you drive your car up the steep slope of the mountain, you can imagine getting walking up there. Franklin's men, they very quickly ran out of breath. So when they arrived on the western side of the mountain, Franklin calls a timeout and he allows his men time to catch their breath, even though McClellan specifically told them in those same orders to Franklin to use all his energy and his intellect, do not pause, do not stop. Well, Franklin, of course, believed he needed to. So he'll wait for about 2 hours at Jefferson, and then he'll continue marching west. He'll arrive at a small, sleepy village called Burkittsville. I understand in the 1990s, that was the home of the Blair Witch. Okay. William Franklin will reach Burkittsville about 12 o'clock noon. And when he got to Burkittsville, he came under fire from Confederate cavalry. Remember Jeb Stuart? That morning, he galloped away from Turner's and Fox's Gap. He made his way south here to Burkittsville, and here he discovered two regiments from Thomas Munford's brigade, a total of perhaps 400 troops. Looking off to the east, at that moment, he did not see any Union troops advancing. Well, they're not coming here either, he thought. So Stuart will continue to move south. Gallops his way out of the picture. He joins McLaws up on Maryland Heights to oversee the bombardment of Harper's Ferry. So Munford is left behind. And then McLaws is getting reports from Munford that there's trouble ahead. Here comes Franklin. They appear to emerge from out of the earth. That's what they said. So Munford is calling desperately for support. And he is going to get a few brigades. Elements of Parham's brigade. It was Mahone's, commanded by Parham. Elements of Semmes' brigade. At most, about 1,100 Confederate soldiers to hold back 13,000. Outnumbered. But when Franklin arrived at Burkittsville, he stops again. And he is then going to settle in for a three-hour lunch. During the 3 hours, from 12 p.m. until 3 p.m., he is getting repeated messages from McClellan. McClellan is with Burnside. McClellan believed his role was to be here because, again, he believed the bulk of the Confederate Army was here. He trusted Franklin. and he is going to send those messages. Do not delay at Burkittsville. Carry Burkittsville at all costs. I am told that there are only 1,500 Confederates at Burkittsville. And he was very, very close in that. Franklin responded, my people tell me there are 4,000 to 5,000 Confederates in Burkittsville. And they're getting that information from Colonel Henry Cake. Colonel Henry Cake of the 96th Pennsylvania is leading the effort of the 6th Corps toward Burkittsville, and he calls out a frightened civilian. Tell me about the Confederates and troop in town. Well, Colonel, first of all, I want to let you know that this town is Union to a man. Just tell me how many Confederates are in town. There are 4,000 to 5,000 of them. Several batteries backed up by cavalry. So that gets reported back to Franklin. And Franklin reports that to McClellan. And McClellan writes back and says, carry Burkittsville at all costs. Well, finally, the 6th Corps has arrived. And the 6th Corps has deployed. And at 4 p.m., finally, Franklin will get his men in motion. At 4 p.m., there was action that day at Fox's Gap, at Frosttown Gap, and at Crampton's Gap. The 6th Corps will move forward with Henry Slocum's division in the lead. They'll advance through Burkittsville, and on the north side of town, they will then encounter that very thin line of Confederates. In some places, the men were standing 8 feet apart. And their advance will come to a stop because those Confederates are well protected behind sometimes breast-high stone walls, and to their front are open fields, and Henry Slocum's men are getting shot down one after the next. For an hour, they're going to stand in this contest. They're trying to fire back at the Confederates. And at 5:30, William Franklin, who remained 1 mile to the rear at his headquarters, he wrote another note to McClellan. 5:30 p.m., I am afraid the pass is too heavily defended. It will not answer to attack tonight. I will try again tomorrow. At that very same moment, three of his officers in the front line looked around, saw their men getting struck down, and said, there's only one way to end this, and that's to do what?
Charge.
Alfred Torbert, Joseph Bartlett, and John Newton, they all rode up and down behind their lines. They had their men fix bayonets, and finally at 5:30, at the same time Franklin was saying it can't be done, those men are doing it. Sweeping across the fields, they would quickly smash through the Confederate line, scale up over the mountains where they were overwhelmed another Confederate brigade sent to their assistance, Howell Cobb's men, North Carolina, Georgia soldiers. Some of Cobb's regiments lose 75%. Those Confederates are crushed, and the 6th Corps has gained Crampton's Pass. Elements will make their way down into Pleasant Valley. Pleasant Valley is the valley between South Mountain and Elk Ridge beyond. And at the end of Elk Ridge, atop Maryland Heights, there is McLaws. McLaws is panicked. Union troops have gotten to his rear. So what does he do? He pulls all but two regiments off Maryland Heights. And he and Stuart would work feverishly into the night to establish a line of defense that stretched out across Pleasant Valley, trying to do whatever they can to stop the Union Army from getting there. Now, by pulling out of Maryland Heights, that also opened the door for over 1,000 Union cavalrymen at Harper's Ferry to do what? I'm getting out of here. So they get out. But that was it. George McClellan does not yet know the outcome of this battle when he would wire the White House. The Corps of Reno and Hooker have carried the gaps. We were everywhere successful. And he would write, of course, to his wife, that those who know battles tell me that this is a military masterpiece. But again, it was largely Burnside's show. Now, he did not accomplish all he had hoped to do. He had hoped to divide the Confederate Army in two and defeat them in detail, while at the same time freeing up Harper's Ferry. He does not accomplish that all on the 14th, but there's still the opportunity to do it on the morning of the 15th, because Harper's Ferry was still holding out. So overnight, he'll finally hear from Franklin, and he'll write back and says, early morning, go south and defeat McLaws, okay? So that morning, he'll send orders to Hooker. Begin your pursuit of the Confederate Army and attack if you find Lee in retreat. He tells Burnside, get your men out of the mountain pass by 8 o'clock. Franklin is told to attack. Well, Hooker gets his men moving, but no one else does their job. Burnside stays at Fox's Gap till about 12 p.m. Franklin will move less than 1 mile south down Pleasant Valley, and he'll encounter that line of Confederate troops, and he will write back to McClellan, "They outnumber me 2-1. Franklin had over 13,000 men. Somehow he must have been seeing 26,000 Confederates in front of him. And by the way, General McClellan, the cannon fire from Harper's Ferry has stopped." Harper's Ferry did surrender that morning. And you could just imagine what was going through McClellan's mind, right? Missed it by that much, right? But Hooker is still following Lee. Hooker is going to advance through a small town called Keatingsville and all the way toward a small creek called the Antietam. And on the other side of the Antietam Creek, there is Lee. Lee has stopped his retreat. And the reason why he stopped? Well, as he fell back, remember, he did not hear back from McClellan. And if he continued all the way to the Potomac, he realized that if he got across, he would be abandoning McClellan in Maryland. So he found a line of defense. And that line of defense was on the west bank of the Antietam. There, he'll put his men into battle lines. And it was at that moment, I think, when what was gained at South Mountain became very clear for Lee. They lost the passes. They lost the mountainside. But what did they gain?
Time.
They gained time. Jackson predicted to Lee that Harper's Ferry would fall. Lee stops, and he ordered Jackson north to Sharpsburg. That's what led to that battle 3 days later. I want to thank you so much. If you have any questions, I'll be more than answer. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Thank you. All right. Any questions? Oh, I dropped my other two markers. I feel like a football coach. Any questions at all? Yes, sir.
John, one of the key questions, criticism of McClellan throughout this campaign, is that he never had a staff meeting.
Yes.
He never sat down and said, "Hey, gang, here's what we're doing." So you know what they're doing, and they know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
He knew what he was doing. At the pitch stop order, of course.
Knew what he was doing. Nobody else. Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps, but who does he trust in this campaign? Porter?
Burnside.
Perhaps Burnside? You know, Hooker's entirely new to Corps Command. He has Sumner, but he doesn't care at all for Sumner. He trusts Franklin, you know, he'll tell Franklin. But you're right. You know, he does play his cards close to his chest. And it seemed like the generals were told when they were needed to be told, and only as far as it pertained to them. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yes, sir?
Why did Stuart take such liberties with changing Lee's order?
Oh, yeah. Jeb Stuart's role in the campaign has come under criticisms lately. There are those who think that he might have dropped the ball a little bit. You know, first in not reporting to Lee the movement of the Union Army north. We know about that ball he had at Urbana, you know, the dance he threw, but you know, even during that dance, what happens? He's interrupted, right? Because the Union troops are getting close. Why is he not reporting this? You know, is Lee just ignoring it? Does Lee not believe it? I don't know. But yeah, Stuart was convinced that McClellan would have been moving the bulk of his army toward Harper's Ferry. He thought that McClellan would be advancing up the Potomac, but instead, of course, McClellan was not. It's interesting that after the Antietam campaign, the Maryland campaign comes to an end, what does Stuart do? Takes a ride around the army, right? Mm-hmm. What does he try to do after Brandy Station? Try to take the ride around the army. So. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir?
How was the fighting like up on those mountains? You couldn't have kept the lines together.
No.
It would have been like hand-to-hand.
Absolutely. The fighting up on South Mountain, you know, it was rock to rock, it was tree to tree. Yep. It's been pointed out, you know, that for a lot of these men, this is the most rugged terrain they'll fight across during the entire war. You know, these men who were not sent out toward Chickamauga later on, of course. But for some of these men, First Corps troops and a lot of Longstreet's men, this is tough. And you're right, it was rock to rock. And the formations are very quickly lost because they'll start doing this and they'll start breaking apart. And that's what the participants will describe. It was confusion. It was chaos. You know, there's an account. The 4th Vermont was part of Franklin's men that turned Crampton's Gap. And Lieutenant George Hooker of the 4th Vermont, no relation to Joe Hooker, he rode his horse up the narrow mountain path, and as he did so, he stumbled directly into the remnants of the 16th Virginia Infantry, over 100 soldiers who were panicked, who were trying to orient themselves, and Hooker's in the midst of these men. So what does he do? He yells out to his men, "Here they are, boys, get them!" And they surrendered. Yeah? Oh, yes. Yep. And his Medal of Honor for that action is on display at Antietam currently. So he got their flag. He got over 100 men just by doing that. So,
is there any record that Robert E. Lee knew about the 191 orders falling at the...
Yeah, this is one of the debates about the Maryland campaign. Mm-hmm. There's one school of thought led by Joseph Harsh and others who said that when McClellan was hanged at 191, there was a Confederate sympathizer in the group. And McClellan, of course, didn't reveal what it was. All he said was, "Now I know what to do." And this fella deduced that it must be important. So he found his way through Frederick, through Union lines, through Confederate lines, and he found Jeb Stuart. And he told Jeb Stuart, "Hey, I think McClellan is in possession of something." And somehow Stuart deduced that it must be 191. So he reports that to Lee. Now, I think that's a rather fantastic tale. There are others who will disagree entirely with that. All Lee knows is that McClellan was moving quick.
Are there any records, though, of him commenting or remarking?
You know, I think after McClellan's report came out, I think he did realize it. I don't know if he made any kind of public comment about it. Certainly, if there was any hint as to who it might have been on the staff of either him or Jackson, they were probably measures taken, you know. But I don't know. I mean, there's a big school of thought that think it was Henry Kidd Douglas. That's why he never advanced in rank for the duration. And that's why he was off the staff. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's one of those mysteries. And someday we'll find those letters and those diaries, right? And I hope. But, yeah, Lee knows that McClellan's moving quick. And I like the language Lee uses in his report. The Union Army had moved throughout the duration of the campaign much too quickly than what was convenient for our purposes. So again, oops, yeah, very good.
Although, yeah. On the 16th,
yes.
Is it like a day of nothing?
Yes, yeah, so on the 16th, McClellan is following Lee toward the Antietam. Now, McClellan has to make sure that Jackson, because in his mind, Jackson had the other 60,000 men. He had to make sure that Jackson was going to move up the Virginia side of the Potomac and not up through Pleasant Valley. Because if Jackson came up the Maryland side, he would be right on his left flank. So he does kind of do this advance toward Antietam while keeping, you know, those guys turned to the south.
How did Jackson?
He came up the Virginia side. Yep, yep. I don't think there was probably anyone more relieved than McLaws and his men. Because when Harper's Ferry fall, they get across the Potomac. And finally, their threat is gone. Yes, sir?
What did Franklin do then?
Franklin?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
What did Franklin 6th Corps do?
Oh, yeah, they stayed there until the morning of the 17th. On the morning of the 17th, they were ordered to Antietam. They get there about noon. They get to the East Woods, and as soon as they get to the East Woods, the battle on that end of the line was at a temporary standstill. So William Franklin gets to the East Woods, and he wants to attack. He looks toward the West Woods and Nicodemus Heights, and he says, "I will take that position." And, of course, here's Franklin, usually very cautious, now wanting to pitch it all in. And now galloping up to him is Edwin Sumner, who had just survived a debacle in the West Woods, saying, "Stop, stop." So in the midst of the Battle of Antietam, McClellan is getting in between a heated argument between Sumner and Franklin. Sumner, who's always on the move to attack, is now saying, "Don't." Franklin, who's "Don't attack," is now saying, "Go." You know, so it was a role reversal. Very good. Yes, sir?
Said Burnside delayed leaving the...
Yes,
camp.
Yes.
Did that have anything to do with the battle we're not talking about?
Yeah, I think it did. Yeah, the question is, Burnside does delay on the 15th getting his men in motion. And he'll apologize for it. You know, he'll try to explain himself to McClellan the reason why he had to do it. But remember, of course, McClellan at Antietam, he doesn't have any use of this wing structure anymore. You know, so he'll send Hooker.
Have your attention, please. The library will close in about 25 minutes.
I've thrown my voice. Hooker is sent to the opposite end of the Confederate line. The Ninth Corps is sent to the very other one. Now, whether that played into McClellan's decision to do so, I don't know. I don't know. But McClellan does ask him, you know, explain yourself. I think even on the morning of the 17th, as the battle's beginning, he wants to know what caused that delay. So, yep, I guess the relations began to break. Very good. Any others? Yes, sir. Okay.
The ghosts.
Yes. Yeah.
Was that not a key reason why Cox and Franklin didn't event? Because they knew there were tens of thousands of reserves just waiting, which didn't exist. But they had been trained to believe.
Well, Cox would say,
yeah,
Cox said it was. It was a very pervasive sentiment in the Union Army, this thought of being outgunned. And that might have been true, but also at the same time, you know, Second Bull Run was only 2 weeks before this, you know, and boy, what happened there? You know, that now that wasn't Cox. Cox wasn't there. But it's really interesting to read when you hear about McClellan being restored to Army Command. Part of the reason why Lincoln does it, of course, is because the affection that he had and the way the men loved him. Not so from the Ninth Corps. You know, Rutherford Hayes is going to write, hey, this McClellan guy is in command. The troops seem to like it. Let's find out what he does. And then after Antietam, there are Ninth Corps officers saying, how in the world did he let Lee get away? You know, Thomas Welsh, one of the brigade commanders, said it was nothing short of treason for Lee to get across the Potomac. So there was no very big attachment from Ninth Corps guys to McClellan. Their man was Burnside. So the big debate between Burnside and McClellan after the war, I like seeing the how they're playing out. Very good. Yes, ma'am?
You said that something happened to Lee's
end. Yes. I think how the story goes, it was on August 31st, and Traveler got frightened, and he tried to rein in Traveler, and it kind of extended the muscles. It strained one of his hand. He had a broken bone in his left hand, and his right hand was sprained. So up until September 16th, he was riding in the back of an ambulance. Yep, splints on the hand. Yep. So a very frustrating campaign. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again. I enjoyed it. Thank you.